Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there, and welcome to My Time Capsule. My name's Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is, as it always has been, the podcast where people tell me five things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish or really love and would like to keep safe, and one thing that they wish they could forget, something they want to bury in the ground and never think of again. My guest in this episode is Nick Newman. Now, Nick is an award-winning cartoonist and writer. He's worked for Private Eye since 1981 and has been pocket cartoonist for the Sunday Times since 1989. His cartoons have appeared in many other publications, including The Guardian, Punch, and The Spectator, and he was the Cartoon Arts Trust Cartoonist of the Year in 1997, 1998, 2005, and 2016. He won the Sports Journalists Association's Cartoonist of the Year Award in 2005, 2007, and 2009. Nick's scriptwriting career with his partner Ian Hislop began either at school or at university, but it went on to include Spitting Image and continued with Dawn French's Murder Most Horrid and The Harry Enfield Show with the creation of the wonderful Tim Nice But Dim. Nick and Ian also wrote the BBC One film Gobble and the sitcom My Dad's the Prime Minister. In 2008, their film A Bunch of Amateurs, starring Burt Reynolds, was chosen for the Royal Film Performance, before being adapted for the stage at the Watermill Theatre. More of that in this podcast. In 2014, their film The Wipers Times won the Broadcast Press Guild Award for Best Single Drama and was nominated for a BAFTA before its stage adaptation and sellout tour. Luckily, Nick also fills in the details of that project, along with, well, lots of other things, as our rambling conversation includes the five things from his life he'd want in a time capsule. So this is Nick Newman. I hope you have as much fun as I did. You and Ian have put on lots of different plays. You've written, when you sit down first of all and say, well, this is a good idea, let's turn it into a play, let's see if it goes anywhere. The idea that eventually people are all going to come together and learn those lines and then perform them and then tour them around the country or perform them in a theatre for a long time. It's so alien to what you're doing at the beginning that you can't really think about it, can you?
No. I mean, it's about the best thing I think we've ever done. I think we've enjoyed doing it more, but it is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And because I think we do so much stuff that is not for an audience, so, you know, doing stuff for Private Eye, you have no idea how it goes down, and I do cartoons which go out into the ether and you don't get any reaction. Seeing a live performance is still the biggest thrill of anything. But it is, I mean, the thing that I've enjoyed most is just the whole collaborative process of being with a cast. And we've tended to have quite young casts, so it's that's quite exciting too, seeing these, you know, young actors that are cutting their teeth on it.
Yes.
And just marvelling, really, at how they do it, you know, how you do it. I mean, the last thing we did, this play about Spike Milligan, and we originally were commissioned to write it for TV and then sort of thought, how can we make it for on the stage? We wanted to build in lots of sound effects because that was sort of one of the defining things of the Goons, was the amazing sound effects, and Spike sort of led the way. And so we wrote a sequence for just somebody, a Foley artist, coming on at the beginning of each half, explaining how sound effects worked. And when you read it on paper, I could remember the producer saying, this isn't very funny. It's just sort of stating things. And I said, we just sort of think it'll be funny when people see it, you know, people. And Margaret Caborn Smith did it. And from the second she's a wonderful performer anyway, but she just did it perfectly. But you don't know until, I can remember watching the very first run through and thinking, yes, it's going to work. And then Margaret came out. You think, yeah, this is good, actually.
Yeah, she's very good. Did I tell you that story that I was sitting on a train and a young man was sitting next to me looking at a script? And then he closed it and I said, oh, I was going to do a play by Ian and Nick before COVID, but it fell apart, sadly. What's that? And he said, oh, I'm just about to do it. And it was the person who was playing Spike.
Oh, really?
John Dalgleish.
Yes. We were sitting next to each other.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, when you finish doing Wicked, come back and do a bunch of amateurs.
Let's do it. It was a lovely cast.
Yeah, it's fabulous. But we literally just announced the cast when it closed down, you know, COVID hit. And they tried to drag it out for about, it was down to matters of days, wasn't it? It was sort of, can we see what happens by Wednesday?
Yes, it was absolutely at that point. I had, for the first time in my career, I think, I had about five really lovely jobs lined up. And I looked at the year ahead and thought to myself, wow, this is going to be a good year.
Wah, wah, wah.
Yes, indeed. Oh, dear. Never mind. But lovely of you to do this. I always think that when you have someone who is, in a way, the power behind the throne, if you don't mind me describing you that way.
Eminence Grease, I think.
It's interesting. It would be fascinating to hear your take on things, your side of things, because you only say what you think through humour.
Well, yes, I've been very lucky to have completely failed as a performer. and thought, well, actually, because I suffer from terrible stage fright, being able to get something on the stage or on television or radio or whatever, it's just been a thrill to be involved with it, really. Mm.
And what's extraordinary is the longevity of it, really, Nick, isn't it? The fact that you and Ian were at school together.
I know. Well, that it is over 50 years now,
which is amazing.
Which is shocking, really. We should have killed each other by now. Really, But no, it's one of the great joys of my professional life is that we have managed to keep going and keep friends, because I know so many writing partnerships who have split up. But I think it helps the fact that we both have other lives.
Yes.
So we collaborate together on Private Eye, and I help write the jokes and work on the cover with other writers like Tom Jameson, Nev Fountain, and Colin Swash and Giles Pilbright. So there's a group of us who sort of write the bulk of the magazine for the joke side.
Yeah.
Ian then goes away and has his sort of journalistic hat on. And so half of the sort of Private Eye schedule is him being a serious journalist and editing that side of the paper. And then Ian goes and does the documentaries and I work at the Sunday Times. And so it's still fun when we get together, I think. That's the essence of it.
Yeah, it's quite. And you can look at each other's work and admire it. That's the point. It must be, I bet he comes in quite often saying, that was a funny cartoon. That was good.
Very occasionally.
No. Very occasionally, yes.
No, we do. I'm a genuine, you know, his documentary stuff is brilliant. And it's led on to us doing things between us, you know, sort of like this film that we wrote called Wipers Times came out of one of Ian's World War One documentaries. So... Mm. I'm the grateful beneficiary of his other hats.
Well, he wears it well, I think. You know, it's impressive that he's remained but unchanged by it all. Because I got news for you? It's been going for a very, very long time.
Hundreds of years. Yes, so I think it started in Pitt's day, didn't it? But you know, like Private Eye, it's still sharp. And there aren't many outlets for really holding the, you know, the powers that be to account. Mm. You know, they've closed down things like the news headlines and things like that.
Yeah, the Now Show is just about to go.
Yes.
In a way, all those schools for young writers, as you would have been yourself, you had that area that you could go into. You had Private Eye and you had Spitting Image. And so yes. There was a place where you could go, an outlet for your humour and a way to hone it.
Yes.
Well, and it's slightly worrying that's
closing down. Yeah. I genuinely don't know what young writers do, how they get into it now. But, you know, we were very lucky, for example, you know, Ian and I had collaborated a bit at university and we'd done a student magazine together. And I was a couple of years ahead of him at Oxford. And I passed on a magazine that I worked on with another friend of mine. But then when he finished and came up to London, we sort of collaborated a bit on stuff for Private Eye. Mm. But then along came Spitting Image, and we hadn't really worked together writing sketches or anything like that until Spitting Image came along. And John Lloyd called up and he was looking for different sorts of writers, and he was approaching cartoonists and, you know, people from Private Eye. And we were just lucky that we fitted some sort of bill. You know, we got on very well with the then script editor, Tony Hendra, and we got a small commission and it sort of built from there.
As these things do. And then people talk about them as if they're historic.
I know. And neither of us appreciated of how big it was at the time. I think our enduring feeling was that it was very disappointing. You know, we'd seen the pilot show, which was pretty much sort of Punch and Judy with politics. And by the time we worked on the very first show, but it had become a sort of sitcoms, sort of little mini sitcoms within a show. So there was a sitcom called The Exchequers, and it was all the old prime ministers in an old people's home, which was a funny idea, but actually, for a topical satire show, you're doing jokes about Harold Macmillan. And
cutting edge.
Yeah, yes. Cutting edge. And, it was things like that, which you just sort of watched it and thought, this isn't very good, really. But it got better. And it got faster and sharper, and it was a very complicated show.
Well, of course, that's in a way that's John Lloyd's skill, yes, isn't it? That actually he throws himself into things and sees what works and very quickly recognizes what works. The same thing happened with Not an 9 o'clock News, same thing happened with Blackadder. You know, yes, the first series of Blackadder has very funny bits in it, but it didn't really work.
No, it didn't gel.
He worked out immediately that, in fact, Blackadder should be the clever character.
Yeah. One of the early sort of dictums from Spitting Image, there was a logic problem. So John was very concerned that everything had a logical follow through. Mm. So in the very first episode, Ian and I wrote a sketch with Ian Paisley having an argument with God and telling God what to do. And God ended up zapping him with a thunderbolt and just sort of puff of smoke. This sketch was quite successful in terms of a pretty disastrous first show, but this was okay. But we said, can we do that again? And John said, well, we sort of killed him off now, so maybe he'll have to be in heaven. But he said, but he isn't in real life.
No.
We can't have Ian Paisley dead from now on. So it was that kind of,
yes,
it took us a while to persuade, you know, that you can just do anything with anybody and they come back and they're completely whole again. The other thing is, there was a real tension between the creative side, sort of Roger, Law and Peter Fluck, and the script editors, because I think Roger particularly wanted it to be pure satire and it was just putting the boot into the government all the time. Mm. Whereas I think the way the script editors felt it should go was to broaden it out and to bring in celebrities. And this was like an anathema to Roger.
Yes.
We don't give those fuckers any more publicity. But Rob Grant and Doug Naylor came in as script editors. They replaced Tony Hendra after the first series.
Mm.
And they sort of turned it round and insisted that we have celebrities. And it just made the show funnier because it actually sort of mirrored what was going on in life. You know, the, yes, way celebs and politicians and royalty were all beginning to mix.
And in fact, those celebrities were the new stars, despite, yeah, the fact they hadn't really done anything.
Exactly.
Easy targets as well, really, I suppose.
Yes, but it sort of made it, just made it richer, the world. It wasn't, I mean, it's a bit like looking at a political cartoon. you know, when it's just straight down the line, putting the boot in, it, you know, if the imagery is good, it can be very satisfying. But often what people really enjoy is when two worlds collide. So you mix up the Wimbledon final and the election, you know, it's yeah. sort of, there's a certain sort of alchemy there, which people think it's immensely clever. Oh, you've managed to get two subjects together. It's not that difficult, actually, but don't tell anybody. You know, it's, but so by series three of Spitting Image, we were writing songs about the Labour Party, but set to Madness records.
Yes.
And it just sort of got the essence of what was going on.
Remember Ronnie Golden doing a fantastic Who song, which had the I Hope I Get Old Before I Die. Like, just yeah. that simple twisting that round.
Yeah, that was one of ours. That was
one. Oh, was it?
Yes.
Very good. Anyway, Nick, we are supposed to, that the concept of this podcast is that we're supposed to talk about five things.
Indeed.
That you'd want to put into a time capsule. So, I mean, I don't know where that's going to take us or what you've chosen, but let's find out and see what happens. So what would be the first thing you'd put in?
Well, the first thing is a pen. And it's not very exciting, but it's Ronald Searle's pen.
No.
Yes.
So it's a very simple, a holder with a nib on the end.
A nib.
And you dip it in the ink.
You dip it in the ink and you scratch it across your art paper.
Well, as he would, yes.
And he would. And, I mean, Ronald Searle, to me, was, you know, the governor of cartoons. Mm. And he created St. Trinian's and he was a brilliant reportage artist. He covered the Nuremberg trials for Time magazine. But it was really the sort of St. Trinian's and his work for Punch that captured my imagination and sort of really encouraged me, you know, made me become a big fan of cartooning. And many, many years later, my friend Ian Hislop bid for this in an auction, a charity auction for PEN, you know, the anti-censorship charity. Mm-hmm. And he bought it for me, which so I was very, very touched. And it comes with proper validation and everything that this was... I think Martin Rosen, the cartoonist who worked for The Guardian, went down to interview Ronald Searle and took away a pen for auction purposes. Yes. But anyway, it's very, very special to me. I did quite a lot of research into Ronald Searle subsequently and wrote a piece for The Oldie about him because he was famously captured by the Japanese in the Second World War. And spent virtually the whole of the war in Changi Jail, which was, you know, absolutely barbaric conditions. Mm. And he and another cartoonist called George Sprod, who was Australian, and amazing that was his actual name. It does sound like a comedy name. But they together produced a comic magazine called The Chunkle. And The Chunkle was a sort of a ploughing tool used for ploughing up paddy fields and things like that. And they produced this comic. They produced one issue at a time and it went out to 10,000 people. So it went wow. circulated around the 10,000 prisoners at Changi Jail. And Searle was, even then, he was a very young man. He was in his early 20s and was doing lampoons of senior officers. And he did parodies of David Lowe's Colonel Blimp series. Mm-hmm. And he was seen as a troublemaker by the divisional chaplaincies. Mm-hmm. And they sent him up the line to work on the Burma Railway. And that's what nearly killed Ronald Searle. But luckily he survived, came back weighing 4 stone or whatever it was, and survived it all. So, so Ronald Searle is a bit of a something of a hero of mine, you might say.
Yes. Do you remember always drawing as a child? Or did you look at it and go, I'd like to do that, and then learn the skill there?
I did always enjoy drawing. From about sort of 6 or 7, I sort of realised I could do it, as it were. Mm-hmm. And when I was at school, I did cartoon strips. And then I became a big fan of Tintin and Asterix and, you know, used to copy those cartoons. But it wasn't really until I got to university that I sort of assumed that everybody else would be able to do it. And when we went to, you know, got up to university, I thought it would be the place would be teeming with budding Willie Rushtons. And it just wasn't. It wasn't like that. You know, there were very few people around who could do it. And my contemporary was Catherine Lamb, who does lots of stuff for Private Eye. Mm. And she was getting stuff into Private Eye, and I was very envious of that. And so I started selling cartoons to Yachting Monthly.
Right.
and put stuff into Private Eye, and eventually I got into Private Eye and Punch and all. Mm. So it was a bit reluctant at first, but once I sort of saw at university that nobody else could really do it, I thought, oh, there may be something in this.
You do go up expecting to meet a lot of like-minded people, but in fact you then form into quite small groups of people. Oh, no, those people who found humour was a weapon.
Yeah.
That was a small number of people. Everybody else, they got the humour, but it never occurred to them.
Yeah.
Strange, isn't it?
I can remember my friend Simon Park and I produced this magazine in our first year called Passing Wind, which this was the magazine that we passed on to Ian. And it was and it was born out of the fact, going up to university and sort of looking at the student journalism, and it was all very po-faced.
Mm.
And it was all style and wanting to do stuff about cultural issues. And we just wanted to do some jokes. And and we put a call out around the colleges saying, you know, anybody who's interested, please come along to a meeting. And one person turned up.
Amazing.
Who was Tony Sarche, who...
Right. Another great writer.
Another great writer. And, you know, we've remained friends ever since. And Tony and Andrea Solomon's, his wife, ended up working on Spitting Image. Mm. And, you know, so of the whole university, one person came along. I mean, there were other people. It was the era of Rowan Atkinson and Richard Curtis and Howard Goodall. But they were a bit ahead of us. And they were focusing on reviews. So the in terms of print humour, we were pretty much the only thing going.
But as you say, it's a small group of people, which is maybe why they've all gone through together. If you look at those people and at the people who've come behind it, they're encouraged to join in. You know, you sort of go, well, come and join our little club, because it feels like that.
Yes. I've been very lucky that virtually everything I've been involved in has been collaborative. Mm-hmm. And so it does feel like a little club. I mean, Spitting Image, you know, we all wrote our own bits, but the most fun was the Friday morning sessions where we were doing stuff right pretty much up to the minute, which was then recorded on Saturday. And it was me and Ian and the late, great Jeff Perkins and Hunter and Doherty and Rob and Doug. And it was just very, very collaborative. You know, we were all throwing stuff into a pot and very bizarre stuff came out of it. But it was great fun doing it. And it's sort of like that at Private Eye. You know, once I was sort of sending stuff into Private Eye, and eventually Ian took over as editor at an unfeasibly young age. And he sort of encouraged me to come in, which was great. But sitting in a room with Richard Ingrams, Barry Fantoni and Peter Cook is wow, you know.
But for them, it must have felt very much like you said earlier, that it was very exciting having this young cast and working with these young people. It's one of the great strengths of it is that the people who've done it for a long time have no fear whatsoever of somebody absolutely new coming in and changing what they do.
No. Well, I mean, they were unbelievably generous. I mean, Peter Cook in particular, who, you know, we all worshipped, but he laughed a lot at other people's jokes, you know, which is not all comedians do that. You know, I've been in writing rooms where people have, you know, dissect your offering. Mm. And you just want the floor to swallow you up.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Peter just you know, ran with an idea, and if it took off, then it was great. You know, and that's been the joy of working at Private Eye ever since. You know, we get together in a group, and nobody is worried about talking rubbish. You know, you're not sort of held to account for it.
No, and you don't mind when you say, "What about this?" People go, "No."
That's a very old joke.
No. We did that last week.
Yeah. That does happen a bit.
I'm sure.
But we're always looking for new talent at Private Eye. And they're, you know, people, we particularly encourage cartoonists. And so it hasn't stopped.
No, and otherwise it would just stagnate.
Yeah.
So it has to. But how lovely of Ian to bid for that pen.
Yes, I've never plucked up the courage to use it.
Right.
Well, would you? I mean.
Well, I know. It's got his ink on it.
Yeah. I love also the fact that it's covered in Tippex and, you know, it's sort of a reminder. It's like going the first time I went to see a Tintin show at the Chelsea Town Hall, and they had all the original artwork for Tintin in Tibet. And it was just breathtaking to see his Bon Dessiné style, which is very, very precise and It's meticulous, and the accuracy of all the drawings is extraordinary. But it was very reassuring to see that he made mistakes, and there were lots of paste-ups, and he was mortal. And you know, one of the fascinating things around the edge of the artwork was little drawings of Snowy in different positions to see whether that worked, or somebody's face from a different angle. Mm. And this is what I get from my Ronald Searle pen, you know.
Yes.
He made mistakes. It's Tippex, it's splatter, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I think if you ever did use it, you could only ever use it as an ink blob.
Yes, yes, do some spray.
Yes. You could say, well, I'm inspired by him. Okay, right, that's the first thing then, Nick. So what's the second thing you want to put in? Right, ad break time. We'll be back very soon.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to part two of My Time Capsule with me and the writer and cartoonist Nick Newman. Let's find out what else he'd like in his time capsule, shall we?
Well, we were talking a bit about Spitting Image, and my second item is a dog chew, because Spitting Image, in its desperate bid to make some money and keep this art studio going, divert commercial things, they did box shorts. But the most fun thing we ever did were these dog chews.
They had a Margaret Thatcher. They had a Ronald Reagan.
This is got a Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
And it's a reminder of the genius of Fluck and Law, really. Mm. That whole period of working on that show for 5-6 years. And, you know, when these dog chews came out, we said, oh, Roger, what's happening to you, know, you sold out. But they are very beautiful items, and we do have a dog, but I've never let him. In fact, we've got a small dachshund, and I think he's rather scared of the Ronald Reagan. so this is the Ronald Reagan. This is the David Owen,
wow.
Which is even squeakier. But ironically, there's a wonderful Neil Kinnock as a clown with Roy Hattersley as his clown nose on the edge of it. And we always referred to Neil Kinnock as the Welsh windbag. Mm. He never stopped talking. And there is no squeak.
The squeak is gone.
The squeak is gone. How ironic is that?
Yes. When he fell in the sea.
Yes, yes, exactly. Lost his voice.
Oh, dear.
But they're a constant reminder of that sort of period of the excitement of doing that show.
There's a responsibility that goes with it, of course. Depending on your politics, you would, with glee, take the mickey out of one person, but also feel, well, is this going to affect this person? There's a judgment there, isn't there, made about, you know, I mean, for example, I met John Major.
Oh, yes.
And was really taken aback by how tall he is, because you have in your head that image of him from Spitting Image.
Yes. I mean, I think we didn't care too much. I mean, I'm a great believer that editors are there to edit. That's their job. And, you know, in terms of Spitting Image, Jeffrey Perkins had to decide whether or not we were being cruel or unfair or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his job. So we just went for the jugular as much as we could.
knowing Jeffrey, he would let it go through, I think.
Oh, mostly. Always. Yes. Mm. No, he was wonderful. And we did two specials for him, and we did NBC specials. But he was always, just things you could mention to him in the pub, and he would remember it, and it would suddenly be in the show, And you think that's great skill.
Yes. There's a very strange thing that keeps cropping up in my life, which is that the line about Ringo Starr in the Beatles that everybody knows, which is, it's not the best drummer in the Beatles.
Yes, yes.
Was written by Geoffrey.
Wow. Okay.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
That's been attributed to the Beatles many times. And, and you go, well, no, it was just a joke that Geoffrey wrote.
It's bizarre how the fictional suddenly gets absorbed into fact. Mm. I was watching a clip last week of a Tory MP recounting the dinner at the Ritz where Margaret Thatcher said about the cabinet and the vegetables, they'll have the same for me, as if this was fact.
But there was a sketch, wasn't it?
It was a sketch. It was a spitting image sketch.
Good Lord.
And, this idiot MP just doesn't know. And it's just gone into the annals. So, yes. I mean, the idea that Margaret Thatcher would ever come up with a joke.
it was also that good.
Utterly ludicrous.
What about the vegetables? Oh, they'll have what I'm having. Well,
yes.
That's the joke, isn't it?
It is. It is. And as writers, we all hated that joke. It's gone down in the annals of history as one of the great spitting image jokes. But because I think it was sent in by an outsider.
Oh, and so
we were very resentful that anybody else was getting something. But it is a good joke. But it is like sort of the only thing that people can remember as spitting image. Whereas we prefer, Ian Lai did this, I think the highlight of our career, and I think it was a big moment for Spitting Image, was at the 1987 election show, which was a live show.
Mm.
Here was a show where we all went up to Birmingham and all put it together, and the performers and the puppeteers and the writers were all thrown into the Holiday Inn in Birmingham together. And that was about the only time. But we ended the show with this song, a parody of Tomorrow Belongs to Me from Cabaret. And we sort of took a punt on Margaret Thatcher winning the election. And thank heavens for the sake of the show, she did, because it looked incredibly on the ball and it was really quite scary. So that was an example of, like Geoffrey. I mean, it was very bad taste.
Mm.
It was basically equating the Tories with Nazis.
Yes. Yeah.
And there they all are in the beer garden singing Tomorrow Belongs to Me and doing Hitler salutes. And
Out to be right.
And it turned out to be right. Who would have thought it?
Oh, my Lord. Maybe things have changed. I think if you did that now, you would almost certainly need to reflect it by having the Labour Party as communists.
Yeah.
As
the way
you would have to be Stalin.
Yeah.
They'd say, well, where's the balance?
Well, you should be able to just have one point of view. You shouldn't always have to.
No, I agree.
To sit on the fence. I mean, even at the time, I remember the FT's, and I revered this FT TV critic who hated Spitting Image to begin with and then came round to it, became a big fan. Chris Dunkley, I think, is the name. And he wrote a thing saying if Tomorrow Belongs to Me sketch had been on the BBC, there would have been tanks outside Broadcasting House the next morning, which true. I thought was the biggest compliment. I think that's the best review I've ever had.
I remember also the extraordinary end to one series, which again was Margaret Thatcher, but the Every Step You Take, Every Breath
I'll
Be Watching You.
Yes.
From my side of it, it was the fact that we recorded it with Philip Pope singing, and he did a fantastic impersonation of Sting. And then they had to get permission from Sting to use it. And he was in Paris, apparently, and he said, no, not only will you can use it, I'll re-record it. So he, in his studio in Paris, he re-recorded the song and then had it biked over to us and it arrived just in time to go out.
Amazing.
His version.
Yeah.
And Philip was very pissed off.
It was rather amazing to get Sting involved with that. It gave us a certain sort of validity, as it were.
Yeah. Would you never think of those people watching it?
No, absolutely. I met somebody at a party who said she'd been at school with Princess Diana, and she said absolutely definitely she has had a nose job and that it happened when she went in to have Harry. And so you just wrote this into a sketch and it made the sun. There was a line saying it was a difficult birth and my nose changed shape. And there it was, a news item. I mean, that was a great power of Spitting Image in those days. You could just say something, and suddenly it was all over the tabloids saying, how dare you? But then five pages of pictures of the new puppet of the Queen Mother or whatever. But
well, happy days.
Yeah, long time, happy days. Long time ago.
Yes, all these things are a long time ago, sadly, but you've still got those dog toys.
So no dog is going to go anywhere near them, that's for sure. No.
Well, they're treasured and they're kept safely in the time capsule for you.
So thank you.
You're welcome. So we've got three more things to put in. What's the third thing?
Well, after Spitting Image, we wanted to write sort of longer things, and we were commissioned to write for Dawn French. We wrote some Murder Most Horrids for her, and then commissioned to write for Harry Enfield, and rewrote characters like we came up with Tim Nice But Dim.
Yes.
And eventually we were asked to write a film, which took a long time coming. But we wrote this film, and it actually got made, which was films never get made.
No.
And it had a stellar cast, including Imelda Staunton and Derek Jacobi and Samantha Bond. But it also had in the middle of it Burt Reynolds. And and in spite of Burt's slightly concrete performance, which pulled it back a bit, it was chosen as the Royal Film for 2008. So this is an invitation to the Royal screening of A Bunch of Amateurs, which was screened in front of the Queen and Prince Philip. And, you know, we suddenly were on the red carpet and meeting the Queen. And it was just such an extraordinary, it sort of, the fact the film was made, the history behind the film was very funny because Burt had real problems with his lines, and it was a case of life imitating art. And the story of the film is about a washed up Hollywood star goes to a small village in Suffolk thinking he's going to play Shakespeare at Stratford. And in fact, he ends up playing Shakespeare in Stratford St. John, which is a small village in Suffolk. So it's sort of amdrams versus professionals, and comedy worlds collide. And the script was, I'm sure we were to blame for it sinking without trace. But the dealings with Burt were very, very funny, because at the get-together, we had a sort of cast meet and greet. Burt had just flown in, and I said to him, I hope you're going to behave very, very badly on set, because this was his character in the film. And he said, oh, yeah, I'll keep them on their toes. And he did. You know, he behaved very... He punched the producer.
Oh, my word.
I turned up on set a couple of times to find that Burt had left that morning.
This is exactly what his character was supposed
exactly
to do.
Exactly what his character was doing. So it was, the whole thing was just hysterically funny. And we knew we were in trouble when Ian and I flew out to the Isle of Man to spend 3 days watching the filming. And everybody, just to be with Derek Jacobi and Imelda Staunton, it was just such a treat. But we knew we were in trouble as soon as we went into the theatre and saw enormous idiot boards, cue cards, with very, very basic lines. And basically, Burt couldn't remember a thing. And it made life very difficult because he had to read it all off cue cards.
It's funny, isn't it? Because if you think of him, he promoted himself. At the end of all those films he made in America, they would always have outtakes, wouldn't they, where he was being very funny, offhand, you know, just improvising lines. And you wonder how difficult it was to set those up.
Yeah.
I don't know, unless something happened.
I think he was unwell when he was with us. We were filming in on the Isle of Man in the middle of winter. And he had pretty much, as a stuntman, he had pretty much broken every bone in his body. And so was absolutely taking so many pain-killing drugs. I think it sort of had an effect on him. But he certainly, you know, when he was in the meet and greet, he was very twinkly. And I thought, hey, he's very old, but I think he'll be okay. Because I said to him once, I said, have you ever played Shakespeare before?
Yes.
And because he was playing the part within the film, he was playing the part of King Lear. And he said, no, Charlton Heston did once. He was doing Julius Caesar.
Yes.
And you know, he was standing up on stage and mumbling his way all the way through it. And people started booing. And Charlton Heston stopped the play and said, look, I agree, it's shit. But, you know, I didn't write it. And I thought for him to tell that story was very funny.
Yeah. And he would therefore get the idea of the film.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen the film. I like it a lot, actually. I think it's a lovely film.
Well, you're very generous, Mike.
No, I mean, there is a true heart to it. The moment where he actually does commit himself to performing it, it really works, I think.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. I mean, we had such a blast doing it. From the moment, you know, we were told that Bert's wig budget was higher than we were getting paid to write the script. I mean, to be fair, Bert's wigs were funnier than anything we wrote. Amazing. I remember while we were making the film that we'd written a sketch with Bert Reynolds and his wig for Spitting Image. And it was he had a talking toupee.
Yes.
And it had sort of come full circle. So, but the thing about the film was, even though the film sort of disappeared without trace, we got to meet the Queen, which was absolutely fabulous. And we were then asked by this tiny little theatre in outside Newbury called The Watermill, which is a jewel, to turn it into a play. So we did. This was the first time we'd ever done anything on stage. And it worked incredibly well as a play because it involved amateurs and it was about acting styles. And that as a thing, we did it for a sort of 8-week run at the Watermill. But thereafter, it's sort of taken off on the amateur stage. And at the moment, I mean, at any given time, there are about 20 productions in production.
Fantastic.
And ever since 2008, there have been literally hundreds of versions of a bunch of amateurs.
I can understand that completely, because the lovely side of it is the fact that although these people are presented as amateur actors and therefore with those traditional senses of somebody thinks they're the star and somebody's a bit too old to play the part and all those sort of things are in it, in the end, they all turn out to be extremely capable.
Yes.
And once they commit themselves to something, they do it really well.
Yes.
And I think that's true of nearly all amateur productions.
Well, we always said that it was a love letter to the amateur stage because we'd all done, you know, from school productions onwards, you know, Andrams, and they've gone terribly wrong and they've got, you know, but they've been fun. But the central conceit that the amateurs are better than the professional doing it is a funny idea. Well, I mean, I have to say it wasn't our idea. It was a couple of writers called Gershfield and Ross who came up with the original idea behind it.
Right.
But then we wrote it up as a script. So, it's amazing to think that, you know, it's been performed from Alaska to New Zealand and everybody gets something out of it. It's and of course, you know, we were going to do it as a touring show.
I was really looking forward to doing it. And what a great part.
You were going to do part of the pompous solicitor who believes that he should have had the main part.
Absolutely. I've been waiting to play Lear all my life.
Yes.
I was born for this part. And along comes this usurper simply because he's been in film.
Exactly. We'll have another go, I'm sure.
Well, yes. Let's go back to the Watermill.
Yes.
I don't mind doing that. Lovely. What a great thing, though. What a lovely thing to have that memory of you were chosen to be seen by the Queen and you were the film of the year. A lovely thing to have done.
It's one of the... It got us into writing for the stage as well. Mm. And from there on, we've thoroughly enjoyed the experience of doing stuff live. It's utterly terrifying, but it's a different world and it's just the best thing ever. And it sort of brings me on to my next item.
Right, number four.
Which is... Am I allowed to do that?
Yes, indeed.
Which is something that Ian discovered in his documentaries, which is this trench newspaper called The Wipers Times.
Mm.
And it was produced in the First World War by officers and men on the front line under fire. They discovered in the bombed out ruins of Ypres, which the Tommies couldn't pronounce, so they called it Wipers.
Mm-hmm.
They found a printing press and these two officers thought, well, let's have a bit of fun with it. And instead of producing a sort of sober journal of record, they produced a journal of jokes.
Yes.
And anyway, Ian discovered this trench newspaper and showed it to me and said, what do you think? And we thought, well, yeah, let's write about it. So we wrote a film initially, which took 10 years to get on. We pitched it time and time again.
And people basically said, nobody's interested in the First World War. And then as it came up to the centenary of the First World War, suddenly Martin Davidson, who's the head of history at the BBC, it landed on his desk. And he said, oh, this is a very different take on the First World War, and commissioned a screenplay. So we produced it as a film, which went down very, very well. It was one of those rare things where we sent the script in and it was greenlit about an hour later. And they said, tell us the cast you want. And we just said, Michael Palin, obviously. Mm-hmm. And 2 hours later, we had Michael Palin. You know, it was one of those sort of dream things. But it all started with this Wife of Times. There are parodies of Sherlock Holmes and a lot of poetry and doggerel, but it's heartfelt and it's written on the spot. You know, if you want to find out what was going on in the Tommies' minds as they were about to go over the top, read The Wife of Times. It's the most amazing historical record.
And in some cases, the last thing that they would have done.
Yeah, exactly.
It's incredibly poignant, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we were all in floods of tears, you know, when we saw the film go out and we knew what was going to happen. And, you know, it was beautifully recreated by our director, Andy Demme, and our producer, David Parfitt, who, you know, lovingly, managed to give it the production values it deserved. Mm. But with the cast of, you know, Ben Chaplin and Julian Rhind-Tutt and, of course, Michael Palin, it was, for us, dreams coming true. But as a result of the film, the Watermill said, what would you like to do next? And we said, well, we think this might work on stage.
Right.
So we did it as a play at the Watermill with a very young cast, and we added a lot more music to it. And we took it on tour, and it ended up in the West End. And then we went on another tour, and it came back into the West End. So it's been, again, that's what just one of the joy, you know, one of the most enjoyable things of my career is working on that.
Mm. I mean, it's often the case of places like the Watermill, where you will work with young actors because they want to work. And in fact, the wages at those places are so low, really,
that
for anybody in the middle of their career, as it were, they would love to do it, but they just can't afford it. You have to have the funds. So in other words, you'll find actors at the end of their career who are able to support themselves, who will happily do those sort of things, like me. or you'll find young actors who are willing to live very frugally in order to work.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about the Watermill is you live on site, you know, mm-hmm. so everybody is on top of each other, but gets a tremendous camaraderie. Every show we've done, I think, how many have we done? Four? But we all get together regularly, you know, the cast. And there's been a bit of crossover because some of the actors from Wipers have been in other plays that we've mm-hmm. done. Because they're all brilliant, you know, we think they're all absolutely wonderful. You know, it's almost like having a rep group of actors.
Great.
We've just been very lucky with all our casts. We've loved them all, you know, and it's no regrets anywhere. The great thing was that we were celebrating the work of these men 100 years before.
Yes.
We believed that their humour, you know, stood the test of time, and so it proved.
Well, I think a good joke is a good joke.
Yeah. That's my four things.
Yeah, sadly, we have one thing that you'd like to put in there and forget.
Well, this takes me back to my school days. I made a terrible mistake on my last day at school by tapping into the chapel sound system and playing rock music in the middle of a chapel service. And as a result, I was asked to leave that day.
Oh, my word.
So the bit of music is a wonderful piece of music by a band I absolutely love called Stackridge, who were sort of on the fringes of being big in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And Stackridge had a wonderful album called Extravaganza. And on the album was a track called Happy in the Lord, which was quite irreverent, as the title suggests. And anyway, I did this practical joke, which was a very, very bad idea. And it still haunts me. You know, I still think, why did I do that? it was a thing because I went to this Church of England school, which was very, very, we had church twice on Sundays. And it wasn't that big a chapel, but they installed a loudspeaker system. So we just thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to tap into that?
Of course you did.
Of course we did. And it was a sort of strange thing because I'd sort of finished doing, I finished all my exams and all that sort of thing. But it just coincided with the fact that occasionally boys would take their own chapel services. They would organise the readings and the lessons. And it just happened quite by chance that Ian, who was a couple of years younger than me, Ian and his friends were doing the chapel service that day. And Ian and his friend Adam basically did the chapel service in the style of Alan Bennett from Beyond the Fringe. And I was sort of listening to this and I just thought, they're going to get into trouble for this because it was quite subversive.
Mm.
Then the music came in, my music came in, and I suddenly remembered, no, they're the ones who aren't going to get in trouble. It's me. I had to go and see the headmaster and... Instant dismissal.
And going through your mind is, I was supposed to go to Oxford. Am I going to go to Oxford?
Yes, yeah. Fortunately, my future tutor at Oxford thought it was funny enough.
There you are, you see. So, in fact, I can understand you putting in this and wanting to forget it and wishing it hadn't happened, but it does reflect exactly what you've done again and again and again. You're inside the system, but you have an irreverent view of it.
Well, my greatest regret, apart from missing the end of term and having that call to my parents, which is just ghastly, and having to pack your trunk and all that. But I love this piece of music and I can't listen to it anymore because it sort of, and I've been to see Stackridge a couple of times. They've reformed and split up and reformed. And I went to see them at the 100 Club about 10 or 15 years ago. And I was introduced to the lead singer, Mutter Slater, who I became friends with on Facebook. And I told him my story and he recounted this during the gig and sort of dedicated the song to me, which was absolutely
wonderful.
Sent
a cold shiver down your spine.
Absolutely. Every single time. Even talking about it now, I've got a little frisson. So, yeah, errors that you make in your life.
Well, I'm very forgiving of it because I think that sort of boldness, that sort of, I think this is funny, that sort of attitude is what's led to you doing everything else. And, you know, taking the risk is what it's all about, I think. So, well done, Nick. But I will put it in there and you can forget about it.
But it's going to be there forever.
It's gone. It's sealed, though. It's in its own private compartment. It's gone. How lovely to talk to you, Nick. How nice to see you.
Well, thank you so much for asking me on. It's wonderful. The vanity of being able to talk about oneself. It's so nice to bring back all those memories of various things you've done and the people you've worked with. And it's that's the joy of it all.
This gives you that opportunity, I hope. And
lest anyone should think that life is a bed of roses. Working as a cartoonist, you're dealing with rejection all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So on a weekly and daily basis. So this is the flip side is where the nice things that happen.
Yeah. You struggled to get four together.
Yes, exactly.
Well, keep very well, Nick. It's lovely to see you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. And all the best of British with Wicked.
Yes, indeed.
For the next year.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Nick Newman. Thanks for listening, especially right to the end like you have done. Do subscribe if you haven't already, and do leave a review or rate the podcast to encourage others to have a listen. You can chat with me and my producer via social media by choosing me or My Time Capsule to follow there. Or, of course, you can email us on mytimecapsulepodcast@gmail.com. Our theme tune is available on Spotify and was written and performed by Pass the Peas Music. This podcast is available ad-free if you subscribe to Acast Plus, where you'll also get the aforementioned bonus podcast every week, which every single listener to it will tell you is really not worth the money. But don't let that put you off. Let's face it, we've all bought a coffee in Starbucks and certainly will again, so we are very used to throwing good money after bad. If that's your nature, then details of how to give us £2.99 a month are in the written description of this episode. Come on, you know you want to do it. Finally, before you get on with your lives, let me tell you that this was a cast-off production and it was produced by John Fenton Stevens. Right, that's it. Do jump forward to another episode, or backwards indeed. We've got loads of them to listen to. If not, then we hope to see you again. In the meantime, I'm off to play with my new boomerang, once I've managed to throw the old one away. Bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.